This is a special presentation from 90.5 WESA. On Tuesday, September 4th, WESA held a community forum on issues facing immigrant students, their teachers, and their families. The forum was held at the Pittsburgh Community Broadcast Center on the South Side. It was one of four forums focusing on issues in education, and it was moderated by WESA reporter Virginia Alvino Young. The public was invited to attend and participate in the discussion, and now we present that conversation.
Joining me, my esteemed panelists, we have Jenna Barron, who's the Executive Director of Alliance for Refugee Youth Support and Education, or ARISE. Hi, Jenna. We have Jackie Perlo of the Education Law Center of Pennsylvania. Nicole Rojas of the Moon Area School District works on the ESL K-12 program. And Betty Cruz, who just does a little bit of everything, but also is the founder of Change Agency and the director of its All for All program that connects ESL educators to one another. So in terms of the space that we're talking about, we really have a spectrum here of folks working on the ground, working in the schools, working with kids, all the way up to sort of the 10,000-foot view, working on policy changes and fairness. So I want to start the conversation just with talking about the lay of the land a little bit, demographics. Pittsburgh and southwestern Pennsylvania, it is a diverse place, but in terms of other metropolitan areas, it doesn't have a huge non-white population, but within that population, it is diverse. Like, there's a lot of diversity within that segment. So, you know, just feel free to take it away, talking a little bit about a snapshot of where the region is right now. Maybe Betty would be great for that.
Sure. I'll jump in. So we have in the Pittsburgh metro area, our demographics are about 3.4% foreign-born, which translates into just over 80,000 immigrants in the region. But I think, I think that surprises a lot of people. I think a lot of people hear that number and think, wow, because they don't even realize that there are immigrants here. So hearing a number like 80,000 plus is powerful. Hearing that there are 4,400 immigrant entrepreneurs and small business owners is powerful, but when you put it in context with other benchmark cities, we still have a long way to go to really be as inclusive and as representative as we could and should be. What I think is particularly interesting is the shift that has happened in more recent years. And I know that's something Nicole will speak to within her school district. But within just the last couple of years, the growth of, or I would say actually within the last 8 years since Bhutanese refugees were first arriving, being resettled to our region, through secondary migration, that number has more than doubled. So about 1,500 Bhutanese refugees, for example, were resettled here. And the community estimates there's anywhere from 5,000 to 6,000 former refugees who are now here. The Latino community has grown incredibly and continues to grow. And I think what's particularly interesting of this newer wave of growth, so number one, there is growth that's happening. Even though we're small, it's a small but growing immigrant community. And it is particularly large with populations that are from, again, former refugees and Latinos. And I think that that's a story that doesn't get told. So you have great organizations, and we'll hear more from them, that are doing this work on the ground. But part of the biggest challenges, I'd say, in our region is just the invisibility because of the natural topography that lends itself to that, and also just people not crossing those bridges and making those connections.
You really hit on something I was going to follow up with all of you on, is why do you think that there is so much of the population and the residents that don't realize that there's so much diversity here? And anything else besides that sort of separation?
Yeah, I think it's human nature. I don't think it's just a Pittsburgh thing, but I do think Pittsburgh has historically, when you compare it to other places, I'm from Miami originally and have lived at other places and that are more transient, and you're just, I guess, more comfortable getting out and meeting new people. Pittsburgh has, the people who are here have stayed here, have deep roots, and there is an insularity issue where we might be very nice, but we're not necessarily welcoming, and that's an important distinction. I know there's a lot of talk about our aspiration to be welcoming, and that's something we certainly talk about too, but it is still an aspiration at this point.
Jenna, what else do you think is contributing to that sort of separation of people being really aware of not only the population that's here, but how it's changing?
Yeah, I think that something that comes to mind is very much how when you are from a different place and you speak a different language, you don't belong to, say, the dominant white culture. Navigating through the broader community and navigating systems that are set up for folks who speak English are a limitation, create limitations for people becoming like engaged and deeply engaged in different social groups outside of their own. I think that contributes to it.
And Nicole, working out in the Moon Area School District, how long have you worked in the district?
This is my 9th year in the district, but my 4th year as an ESL teacher.
Yeah. So how have you seen the demographics change in those relatively short amount of years?
So when I started 4 years ago as the ESL teacher, we had about 15 English learners at the beginning of the year, and now we have over 100. So we've seen a 550% increase in the past 4 years.
And I would say when Nicole was one of the participants in our professional learning community for ESL teachers, and I remember even at one point in that year-long process, you said there were like, I don't know, 80-some, and I asked you the next month, and there were over 100.
Yeah.
So I think even in the last year, it's been significant,
feels like. Every year it has doubled. And then sometimes in a couple of weeks it doubles. So, one of the things that I have noticed in response to why don't people notice is in the school setting, and these are a great thing that you parents have clearances and they come in to help at school and they have all of this together. But when you have parents who are new to Pittsburgh or new to the United States, sometimes they don't understand all of the things that they have to go through to be able to enter the school, and also sometimes they aren't able to complete those things. So you might have a parent who wants to participate with their third grader's class, but they really don't have a means to be able to do that during the school day. And so as the ESL teacher, it's my job, I feel, to find ways to help those parents know how they can participate and offer them opportunities to get involved in ways that they can, because it's not necessarily something that naturally just happens.
Right, and I'd love to talk more in a minute just about some of those specific challenges and barriers that so many of these populations, not just the students, but their families face to succeeding socially and academically here in Pittsburgh. But Jackie Perlow of the Education Law Center of Pennsylvania, I'd love to bring you into the conversation as well. This boom that we're seeing, how is it impacting what you're seeing in your work and any questions or concerns that you're fielding from families?
So I think that one of the main changes that we've seen in Western Pennsylvania and Allegheny County specifically is the growth of immigrant and refugee populations in school districts outside of Pittsburgh Public. I think that Pittsburgh Public has seen these communities and engaged in work with these communities for a long time, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but it's really the growth of immigrant communities and refugee communities in other suburban areas, further out into the county, where we're seeing a lot of the issues that school districts that have been working with immigrant populations and have been dealing with unique challenges that they face now are having to experience those and work through those. So how do you translate materials for parents? How do you create a successful ESL program? How do you enroll children and students and families when they have unique needs and language requirements? So I would say that's one of the big things that we're seeing is, a district that maybe they've had one or two limited English proficient parents enrolling their children before, all of a sudden now it's 10 or 20 or 100, like we heard about in Moon. So that's really a major change, a major shift that we've seen over the past few years to the past last decade.
And you touched on a few of the tangible things that districts need to put in place to sort of catch up to this boom that's happening and the accommodations that they're having to make. But Betty and Nicole, what are some of the tangible and intangible things that districts need that just they haven't had time or haven't been able to put in place to accommodate this population?
Well, one of the things that districts have to do is they have to provide translation and interpretation for families. So maybe in the past, a school district had 3 or 4 English learners, but maybe their parents were already English speaking. And so sometimes we will have English learners that come, let's say we have a family from India whose parents speak English, but their child didn't go through the school system in India, and so they are still learning English. And so with that family, the ESL teacher's working with the child, but it's very easy to communicate with the parents. There's not that barrier there. So when you have a big change, for example, like our school, we have 18 different countries represented in our ESL program and 20 different languages.
20 different languages. What is the student population?
The English learners are total?
Total.
About 3,500.
Okay, and within that population, 20 different languages. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so providing translation and interpretation for families for really everything that they could come across is a huge undertaking. And so figuring out how to do what legally you are required to do and what is also beyond that, what is best practice? You know, how are you reaching these families? It's a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, Benny, feel free to add on, but also are the resources available for schools to access these translation services? Is it a tremendous financial burden to the schools?
The resources are available, but you have to, if it's important with anything in any institution, if it's a priority, you invest in it.
It's also a requirement for these schools,
right? That should matter too.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it's a priority, it should be part of your budget. But I wanted to go back to what Nicole was saying and build on that. To me, so what we need from our administrators, what we need from superintendents, what we need to see from districts is that they see ESL teachers as valuable. There's a challenge within our different districts, and I think that this is cross-cutting. Some are better than others, but there is definitely part of why we created this professional learning community is because we were hearing from teachers and from students and from families that ESL teachers felt like they were on an island, and when you, in terms of being disconnected from the resources, disconnected from the immigrant-serving organizations, and also not heard within their own institutions when they tried to advocate for those resources, for those families, for the work that they do, they're not seen in the same level as their peer, as general ed teachers. A lot of times the challenges that youth are facing within the schools, hearing teachers say things that are quite offensive, having teachers not really be as, or staff or administrators be as welcoming, it's coming, unfortunately, from the general ed classes. It's coming from other administrators. So when you talk about a position like an ESL teacher that is oftentimes, one or a couple within a school, obviously it depends on the size of the school, but they're not the loudest voice, so they're not given the credit that they deserve. Two more things that I would say is that you also need to see immigrant families as assets. You have to recognize that their voice matters and that they are not being difficult. It's just a different experience. And the third thing I would say is that different experience is not a bad experience because it's not the American way. I think that's another frustrating point is we expect parents' engagement should look a certain way, but you know what? For my parents, for example, who immigrated to this country and worked 6 days a week, 13 to 15 hour days, they did not have the luxury of taking part in some of these extra activities that feel nice. So sometimes it's a luxury and a necessity issue. Sometimes it's just we do it differently in our country and different is okay.
This is a special 90.5 WESA presentation of a community forum on issues facing immigrant students, their teachers, and their families. The forum is moderated by WESA's Virginia Alvino Young. The panelists are Jenna Barron, Executive Director of Alliance for Refugee Youth Support and Education, also known as ARISE, Jackie Perlow from the Education Law Center of Pennsylvania, Nicole Rojas, ESL K-12 Program Specialist in the Moon Area School District, Betty Cruz, founder of Change Agency. We now rejoin their conversation.
Jenna, you work with so many families directly. And so what are you seeing, as we've heard obviously that there are some barriers in terms of expectations, but also in sort of maybe comfort in seeking resources or engaging, or maybe just being familiar with this traditional academic structure. So just kind of what brings all of us here, when we're talking about this specific population of immigrant and refugee families, I mean, what are some of those hurdles that go beyond just academic success that before they even get to school might be a challenge for some students?
Yeah, when I think, of course, because it's the work that we do, when I think in the context of out-of-school time programs, which is the work that we do, so all of our programs are extracurricular. While there is a focus on educational advancement, it's also a focus on enrichment and a space for students to share their voice and share their story. Of course, it's when developing relationships with families, there's also kind of this need to explain and justify something like our programs. Right, because a lot of times families are trusting the school to do the job that they're supposed to do, which is to provide their child with a quality education so that they can do what it is that their parents fought so hard to get them here for. And then it's also a conversation of, yes, school is very, very important, and also, it's very important for students to be engaging in extracurricular activities where they can really develop leadership skills, where they can develop relationships with students outside their typical social groups so that when it does come time to graduate, when it does come time to going to college and being prepared, these are things that are really important to have. So that's usually a conversation. Another barrier, too, a lot of our students are in high school, and sometimes they're as old as 21, 22. And so there definitely is a responsibility that they feel to be working and providing for their families. So when we are talking with students about taking advantage of our program, oftentimes they are torn. Do I do this? Do I attend the summer program, or you know, do I continue to look for a job so that I'm able to contribute to my family? And so it's tough for us because we want them to be able to do both things, but obviously providing support to families. So there are barriers for students, of course, to be able to partake in maybe what there is. I referred to kind of like this dominant white culture earlier and kind of what it means to be successful as a young person in the U.S. So that we can do the things like go off to college. But there are real barriers to being able to do that when there are responsibilities to support your family. So those are also things that our students talk about a lot and that our parents talk about a lot.
I think based on all of your experiences, you could really speak to some of the additional stressors when you're a young student coming from an often marginalized community that might impact academic and social success. What might some of those things be that you've seen?
I think we've seen certainly a huge rise in concerns from families about ICE being at schools, near schools, at bus stops. That's been a huge issue and concern. The other one that we hear a lot of is a heightened increase in bullying and harassment, especially around immigration status, language acquisition, national origin. I always like to make the distinction that bullying really exists. Bullying happens when a child is severely, there's severe conduct that's offensive that affects the child's education in some way. Harassment is when that conduct is based on some sort of protected class, so the child's ethnicity, their national origin, their race, religion, if they have a disability. So when this sort of bullying is happening and it's around where a child is from or what language they speak, that's not bullying, that's harassment. And it has a whole other level of legal protections and rights and enforcement mechanisms that's really a strong and important distinction for families to know about and brings with it a whole bunch of extra protections in the school itself and requirements on how schools need to address harassment as opposed to just bullying. And unfortunately, a lot of this negative rhetoric that we've seen on the national scale has permeated into our schools and teachers and students, or excuse me, students and teachers, unfortunately, repeating those sorts of things to families and to students. So I think that's one of the non-academic things that are really, really affecting students' experiences in school in unfortunate ways.
And I think that trauma too, because it's an added layer of trauma for, in many cases, children who their parents either fled under duress and trauma, or maybe the children fled with the families if they immigrated here with them. But I think the other aspect of that we've heard on occasion as well is the pressure that the child who's afraid for their family's safety, that their parents are going to get picked up, or that their parents were picked up, which is obviously increasing as well. There's also a ripple effect to their peers who are afraid that their friend is going to not be there tomorrow. And that creates a stress in the classroom as a whole, in the community as a whole.
Nicole, is that something that you're seeing in your district as well?
Definitely. I've had situations where over a few days, a student starts to act a little bit differently than normal, and only after a week of checking, are you okay, what's going on, do they open up and say that dad has been detained, mom's taking care of the 6 kids, she doesn't have a job, they're running out of food. You know, this has happened before. And as the ESL teacher, because I participated in the PLC and because I have been through some amazing professional development.
Can you clarify what the PLC is?
Yeah, the professional learning community through All for All for ESL teachers. That introduced me to so many different resources in Pittsburgh. I was able to connect that family with the Latino Community Center, and then they were able to connect them with an organization that helped to get that family back on track, take care of a month's rent, and get them connected to a lawyer that ultimately dad's back home. So, you know, as the ESL teacher, that's where my role, I feel, comes into play, instead of just saying, oh, I feel bad, that's really rough, you must be going through a rough time, is being willing to take that extra step to check in, call home, see if there's something that can be done. And when I remember when I had that conversation with the mom, she was in tears, and I didn't know if I really could help her. I didn't know what I could do, but I said, let me get you in touch with someone.
We have a question. Feel free to introduce yourself and let us know.
My name's Riley Diffenderfer. I'm a teacher with Pittsburgh Public Schools, an ESL teacher. And kind of on the subject of what Jenna was talking about, and also Jackie, the lack of infrastructure to help a lot of ESL students with issues that are separate from what students experience in the dominant white culture of being a student here. Are there any programs or any kind of infrastructure in Pittsburgh to help overaged and undercredited ESL students? Because I taught ESL in a different city, and I just moved here recently, and I am very distressed to see 22-year-old students in the same class as a 14 or 15-year-old. It's not good practice, and it shouldn't be done. And I'm just wondering, there has to be a way to get these students some credits, to get them a GED, to get them on the track to going to a community college. So I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
To my knowledge, the only programs that are available would not be specific to English learners. They would be those like credit recovery programs like Passport Academy, and other kind of GED programs, which, as you can imagine, are just like hard for everyone. So imagining taking those courses when English isn't the language that you're comfortable with yet, that's definitely a real challenge. I know a lot of our students who are in that situation just end up doing the Job Corps program, which is what the kind of Pittsburgh Public Schools, I think, has a relationship or is used to referring students to Job Corps. But that's also something that we've noticed, and in fact, some of our students who come to summer camp are 21, 22, and have aged out of school.
And so it's something that we're looking at as well, because there is a huge gap in terms of supporting those youth so that they don't have to go right into work, into doing something that isn't personally fulfilling, but they actually have the resources to be able to go to college and pursue a career that they're personally interested in.
I think the other thing that's important to know is that in Pennsylvania, students have a right to attend school until the age of 21 or until they earn enough credits to graduate. So if a student arrives in the United States or in Pittsburgh at 18 or 19, that child still has a right to be in public education. The school cannot and should not be saying that they have to go to some other alternative program that might be lesser or inferior. The schools themselves, the public schools, need to have the systems, the programs in place to provide education for that child, to meet them where they're at, to provide ESL, other enrichment, academic programs. So after age 21, it does become a lot more difficult because the schools don't have that requirement. But these children between age 18 and 21 often fall into this, what people think of as a gray zone, but it's not gray. They have a right to be in a normal classroom. That doesn't mean they should be, you know, with 14-year-old peers, and schools need to navigate that and figure out what the best practices are and how to meet those students where they're at, which can be particularly challenging if that's a student that's had interrupted education. So if they, you know, didn't receive formal education for, you know, a few years or several years, but that responsibility falls very squarely on the school. And so I think we really advocate for kids staying in classrooms with academically appropriate and age-appropriate peers, that that's where they can get the best education and set them up for success. Enrichment programs are a great add-on to that and a great way to ensure that additional supports are provided, but it really is the school who should be educating those children.
And if if I could jump in there, part of that involves when the student registers for school, making sure that there's a conversation with the guidance counselor. Where has this child been? What credits do they have? What does graduation look like for this student? And I have a few students who one of them's 18 this year, and she needs a lot more credits to graduate, but we looked at her transcripts, we looked at what she had so far, and we had an honest conversation with her about what does it look like to get you to be able to graduate, and we set up her schedule according to that. So if she chooses to stay till the year that she starts out at age 21, then she will graduate with her high school diploma. So, you know, and that conversation is something ongoing, and it's something that she knows that she has the right to be able to do that, and that's really important. So that she, you know, and that student chose to come over the summer as well, and I think it's really empowering to have that conversation with those students who are 18, 19, 20, and talk to them about this isn't just, you know, filling space for the time being. This is so you can have a diploma, and these are the things that having a diploma can help you with down the road, and helping them to value that as well.
I just wanted to jump in on both of those points. So the words academically appropriate were used, and that's obviously very important, but I want to just dig into that a little bit more, because I think part of the challenge of what we've heard is that it almost feels like a subjective decision-making process in terms of what's academically appropriate. We've heard from too many young people who have been placed in grade levels or coursework that's actually beneath them because the admissions person or the counselor didn't understand what they were dealing with. Literally did not understand it, because maybe the materials weren't translated, because maybe just the description of the course in India looks different than it does here. So the problem with that is then these kids are placed in tracks, right? We all know that that's one of the challenges that we're working within. And if you get tracked in a level lower than you, then you're doomed. And that's your fate is sealed in a certain regard.
Are you seeing bias and expectations play into the ways in which you say it's maybe a partially subjective determination as far as where students are placed? Are you seeing that play into the determination?
I mean, I don't know if, and I'll turn it over to some to the other panelists to weigh in. I don't know if it's necessarily bias. I can't imagine that that's not at play in certain circumstances, considering that we know that children who are Black and brown are more likely to be, you know, penalized and more harshly and all that follows with that. So I imagine that there's some of that at play. But I also think it's just ignorance, just not knowing what to do, how to make sense of this, and not having the or tapping into the resources to help you.
I completely agree with Betty that I think there almost certainly is both explicit and implicit bias in these systems. But it's also that a lot of times the actual infrastructure and the system itself isn't created and interpreted in a way that works for immigrant and refugee and English learner students. So I think a really good example is gifted programs. So gifted programs legally have to be accessible to English learners. You can't be excluded from a program simply because you don't have full English proficiency. But if there's a test to get into that program, so an IQ test or some other sort of objective test that isn't interpreted or isn't translated, then that access is completely cut off. So that is an illegal barrier to accessing a program that English learners have should have full access and full rights to. So yes, there's the implicit and explicit bias, but there's also the fact that the programs aren't set up, that the systems aren't created and implemented in a way that really is equitable.
I mean, if it's an illegal barrier, are there existing schools and districts right now that are not in compliance with that? Are you fielding complaints, and has there been an uptick in complaints about attempt to accessible?
So I think when you're talking about those gifted, AP, those sorts of programs, we hear those complaints, but we don't, you know, it's hard for us in a lot of ways to know what the program is without filing a formal complaint. We are able to access data, and so we can see that there are districts in the area that have, let's say, 5% of their population are English learners and 0% of the gifted program are English learners, and that obviously is a red flag. The question, you know, we're lawyers. we go through legal systems, and it's always a balancing act of how much of working with districts is collaborative and how much is oppositional and what's the appropriate strategy and tactic to use. There are legal avenues. There are both administrative and then court-based complaints that you can file. So schools know this, and hopefully they have that that knowledge in the back of their head and are considering it. But certainly there's issues to weigh when deciding if a formal complaint is the way you want to go and if that's going to create real change. And we've seen instances where those complaints do create change, and then instances where maybe you get a great court hearing and it's not implemented in the long run. That's one of really the barriers of going through the legal system, and one of the reasons why grassroots advocacy and working with communities and having community groups and families and parents actively engaged is so, so important.
One more question. Feel free to introduce yourself and let us know your question.
Linda Theophilus. I'm a pastor. My congregation's been involved in working with asylum seekers. My question is really about the needs of students and their teachers when the students do not need ESL, but the kids and the parents are facing some of the same kind of, how do we navigate this system? How do we advocate for what's best for our kids? And teachers and social workers who are genuinely doing their very best, but maybe don't have access to a lot of information about immigration law or what kind of, how to deal with the trauma that kids have been through. So my question comes down to what's in place and what needs to be in place so that teachers and social workers who are trying to do what's best for non-ESL immigrant kids can have the same kind of support that I'm hearing the ESL teachers are now getting. And with that, I want to ask about trauma, kids that have experienced trauma and it's affecting their behavior and their schoolwork.
I feel like in answering that question, we like have to also recognize that the school system in general is inequitable, and that Black and Brown students are systemically marginalized from opportunities. They are most impacted by a lack of resources, and trauma applies also to students who are not immigrant students. And so I think, at least for me, and this is, and I don't work in a school, though I work closely with them, it always, to me, comes down to just intentionality about, and like a commitment to making sure that students are getting access to what they need and that families are getting access to what they need. And I think a really good example is the one that Nicole actually just gave regarding the student who needed to have so many credits before she was able to graduate, and to have teachers and counselors to sit down with that person and evaluate how far they have come, what their specific individualized needs are in order to be able to achieve the goals so that they can graduate from high school. That individualized support is, I think, really rare when it comes to the school system in general, not because educators don't know it's necessary, but simply because of the system of public education that we have, particularly in districts where the majority of students are Black and Brown. So I think it's just important, I think, for us to recognize that, like, systemically, you know, it impacts so many students, and then, you know, English learners, of course, because of the, and you know, additional barriers with language and culture. It just, like, is another barrier. So I just, yeah.
I would just add to that, the kind of going back to the general ed teachers and the counselors and making sure that everyone within the school understands the importance around this, and we're all rowing in the same direction and want to understand, want to see value in all of the families and all of the youth who are there. And I don't mean to be too hard on the general ed teachers, but that is, you know, they're there, they're showing up, they have their job to do, they have their lesson plan, and I understand teachers do such a hard and important job, but there has to be some self-awareness and flexibility and openness and understanding of how to meet the needs of different learners, including multilingual or English learners. But I want to say something that's actually maybe a little silly, but a different type of anecdote to illustrate this, is one of the teachers in our PLC teaches at the elementary school level and in the South Hills, and she was sharing once with us how one of her elementary school kids, a general ed teacher, was really, really frustrated because this kid was not doing the assignment. And one of these assignments was so simple. It's a coloring assignment that you get around Thanksgiving where you have to color the turkey and you have to dress up the turkey. So you can dress the turkey up as a pilgrim with a little hat. You can dress the turkey up as whatever, it is an elephant, whatever you want. But fundamentally, the child is like, why am I coloring this turkey and why am I supposed to dress it up? It doesn't make sense. And even if the parent is right there working with the child, it doesn't make sense. So this is something very simple, maybe overly simple, but you get the point.
It gets at the nuances, right? Yeah.
But also that child is showing signs that they're thinking so critically and challenging what's being put in front of them. So maybe they are the ones who should be paid extra attention to as a potential candidate for something like a gifted program. Did you have something?
Yeah, cool? I just wanted to add that, to go back to your question too, and what Betty was saying earlier, that it's one thing to say hi and, oh, that's so interesting, tell me where you're from, oh, what do you eat there, and see it as, this person is so interesting. It's a very different thing to really sit down with somebody and get into their space and let them share with you what their needs are and be willing to do the work and take the time to meet those needs. And anytime a family comes through the door who, you know, they have to fill out a home language survey, That's one of the first things they do when they register at school. So if there's multiple languages on the home language survey, even if they're not an English learner, there's still that point of time that I meet them. Or, you know, now in Pennsylvania, a parent interview is required if there's multiple languages on the home language survey. So in that conversation with the parent, you know, asking them, does the schedule look okay that your student has? Or, you know, what did they enjoy in their home country? And there are students who don't qualify for English language services, but they still might be that student whose transcript is misinterpreted or whatever it may be. And it requires a lot of time. And the thing is, that is not necessarily something that's, it is required, but there's no specific, you must sit down for this amount of time with this family. And so getting people on your team, inviting people to welcome others with you, and that's more than just saying hi and, oh, that's cool that you're from that country, or what do you do there? You know, actually getting down to what do people need. It takes time, and you can't just be one ESL teacher or one counselor. There have to be more people on board. So I think that's when you'll see students having their needs met, when everyone is on board and people are willing to take a little extra time.
This is a special 90.5 WESA presentation of a community forum on issues facing immigrant students, their teachers, and their families. The forum is moderated by WESA's Virginia Alvino Young. The panelists are Jenna Barron, Executive Director of Alliance for Refugee Youth Support and Education, also known as ARISE, Jackie Perlow from the Education Law Center of Pennsylvania, Nicole Rojas, ESL K-12 Program Specialist in the Moon Area School District, Betty Cruz, founder of Change Agency. We now rejoin their conversation.
And we'll get to more about solutions and culture also in just a moment, but since we've touched on this, another quick question from the audience. Where and how have community college systems partnered with secondary schools to provide transition programs for the 18 to 21-year-olds that are in that gap? What have we seen?
There is a program through the Neighborhood Learning Alliance, which is a partnership with Carlow University, where there is actually like a 6-week program for 6 to 8 weeks, where students are actually taking college courses and getting college credit. And part of those courses, you know, they're not just like thrown into a college level class if they're not ready for it. There is actually a remedial course to make sure that students are where they need to be able to get those college credits. So really that's the only program I'm familiar with that does that work really successfully and that engages immigrant students. So regarding community colleges, I think that there's a real space for them to step up and be involved.
So I wanted to take a few minutes to really kind of tease apart ESL for, it sounds like there's some folks working directly in the space and maybe some folks that are just interested in the space. So just to, again, to tease this apart a little bit, what is it? What is the purpose? How is it structured and how is it different from district to district? I know this is kind of your world. But actually, Betty, first, just what is it? What is the purpose that it serves in the schools?
Well, I feel like it's more of a Jackie question.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about what it's supposed to be.
Sure. And then maybe Nicole,
and then
we'll get to reality,
can talk about
here.
What it is, yeah. in practice. So there are legal requirements for what an ESL program has to look like. And if we even step back from that, ESL, English as a Second Language, is actually just only one type of English language acquisition program that's out there. It's by far the most common in Western Pennsylvania, but bilingual education, we see that a lot more in Philadelphia, where there's a much larger Spanish-speaking population, because bilingual requires that really the bulk of the education, or and sometimes half of the education is done in the student's primary language and then half is done in English. Here we have such a diverse population of languages that sort of model doesn't really work. It doesn't mean it couldn't work in the future, but so we see ESL, English as a Second Language, as the much more common language acquisition program that's in use in most districts. Legally, what's required of an English language program are three things.
the program has to be sound in theory. So there has to be some sort of research supporting that it's an actually a program where students learn how to speak English and access the general curriculum. So ESL has long been accepted as one of those types of programs. It has to be adequately implemented, which has a whole slew of things that are required under that, and I can go back to that in a second. And then the third thing, it has to be successful. So it can't just be that you picked a program, you're putting in place all the resources, but no child's learning, no child's actually exiting out of that program because they've become fluent in English. So just to return to that second piece, the implemented adequately, that's really where the meat of what needs to go into an ESL program is. And there are a bunch of different requirements that federal courts and also the Department of Education through their enforcement arm, through their Office of Civil Rights and the investigations they do, have come out and really clarified for schools what needs to be in an ESL program for it to be considered appropriate. So students have to be monitored. They have to be identified appropriately for the program. So you need to have objective criteria to determine which students actually need to be in ESL. You can't just sit down with a kid and say, oh, do you need this? Do you speak English? There has to be objective criteria. The programs have to be adequately staffed and resourced. So there have to be enough teachers. There have to be appropriate materials. There has to be a classroom that's big enough to fit all these students. The students need to be integrated with their peers as much as possible. So there are different models where students who are English learners are separated for some period of time. They're typically called welcoming programs, something like that, where a student who's new to the country or students who are new to the country might be separated in a all-day ESL program. Those cannot go on forever. Students cannot be in welcoming programs for 12 years of education. They need to be integrated with English-speaking peers. There has to be access to special education is another big piece of this. English learners have the same rights as all other students, so that includes the right to special education, that includes the right to disciplinary proceedings done appropriately, but we often see a real barrier when it comes to special education because a lot of times the assessments aren't available in their language or the psychologists who are doing those assessments don't have the cultural competency to really understand what is a disability and what isn't, what is just culturally different for those communities. And then, like I mentioned before, there has to be access to gifted programs, so special education, but also gifted programs, AP classes, extracurriculars. Students cannot be barred from those simply because they don't speak English. And then finally, students have to be identified, but they also have to be appropriately exited from those programs. You can't be kept in ESL indefinitely. Once a student has become fluent in English, they have to be entered into the mainstream with appropriate supports and resources, and they need to be monitored in order to ensure that that exiting was done appropriately. So that's really, in a quick nutshell, what needs to be in an ESL program for it to be considered legally sound. And then, as I mentioned before, the program also has to be successful. It has to be monitored as an entire program, not just the individual kids. So if you are putting all those resources into place, you have all those supports, but kids aren't learning English, then schools legally are required to go back and make changes to their programs and figure out why it is that kids aren't succeeding, why students aren't learning, and then change the program so that they do learn and they do access, can access the general curriculum.
Lastly, I just want to talk about what is working, sort of from each of your relative perspectives. So generally speaking, from the student perspective, when you've seen a student just kind of crushing it, just finding opportunities, what is the secret sauce there that's kind of coming together to make that a possibility for them?
And thinking about this kind of combined with the last theme as well, in terms of like what ESL programs, what it looks like. Something that I've learned through just anecdotes from students, but also from teachers who have gone above and beyond to connect with me and our organization to connect their students to summer programs and after-school programs and added support, is that the ESL classroom is really, and it could be, a really special place in the school itself. when you think about students who are immigrants and refugees, you know, like imagine yourself as a 12-year-old who just moved to Pittsburgh and have lived here for 2 months, and you speak Spanish, but primarily in an indigenous language. You're only with your father and your brother, and your mom and your sisters are back home. You don't have any friends yet. You don't even know what school you're going to after the summer ends. I mean, these are all things that are making me anxious just thinking about them. And then schools really do have an opportunity to create a space where students feel a sense of belonging, which is something that we all need. And I think I've noticed that ESL teachers, some have really kind of taken advantage of that space that they have to create community with their students, because they have a class of 30 to 35 kids who are all kind of navigating similar challenges. But they find a space where they all have, they feel safe developing relationships with each other and sharing their stories. And in the one case I'm thinking about, their pictures are all over the wall, and you know, their work is all over the wall. And you know, it's really empowering, and I think really important that we are creating community for all students, but especially when we think about students who are trying to make a new home in Pittsburgh. I think there's an argument to be made that it's especially important. And which goes to our programs. We organize out-of-school time programs to support the educational and socio-emotional needs of immigrant and refugee students. So what that looks like is we have a flagship program, which is a summer camp, a lot which was created simply because as undergraduate tutors to English learners, we realized that a lot of our students were not connecting with out-of-school time programs. They weren't spending the summer, you know, at a summer camp and having a good time, and as it relates to academics, practicing English so that that transition back into school was a bit smoother. So we have a summer program that really works on developing those literacy skills, but also a focus on utilizing creative expression to share stories and to kind of develop confidence in personal talents and interests, as well as an after-school program and a smaller support group for immigrant women that is also an art-based curriculum. And all of our programs really center art and storytelling and relationship building, because we realize that there is a significant need, of course, for the academic support, but I think even more so for students to really feel a sense of community, to have mentors and people that they turn to when they want to advocate for themselves, and that's what we aim to do.
So the benefits of enrichment programs, obviously, but when you're talking about in the school and needing that sort of leadership and vision, I mean, culture is a tough nut to crack within any institution, any organization. What are some other sort of keys to success in that realm, either tangible or intangible, that you've seen working or think could work, Betty?
Well, I think we've definitely seen within some of the school districts that they're recognizing that this growth is good. It's good for our region. It's good for the vibrancy within their schools. I know that Nicole, when she applied to be part of our professional learning community, her, I think maybe as a super assistant superintendent, like proactively wrote a letter of recommendation on her behalf. We didn't require a letter of recommendation, but they were just so excited about this. So we're seeing more and more districts be excited about the opportunity that comes when you engage immigrant families. But there are, like, so even though Pittsburgh's in this place that for a long time, you know, we were losing population, this is why we don't have these systems set up. This is why we're behind so many other cities. We're not alone in this. There are so many best practices across this country. There are so many cities that have gotten it right because they've had a constant wave of immigrants. So I think that there are resources to look to those best practices. Welcoming America is a national organization that has a toolkit on building welcoming schools. In our PLC, one of the teachers took one of those lessons from that toolkit and worked with other teachers, Gen Ed and others in their school, to create an integrated learning experience. So the resources are there. We don't have to start from scratch. There are amazing things happening locally here as well. So that's one example of a national one. But Global Minds Initiative locally has become a resource for the kids who are in English learners, for teachers who want to bring these programs to their schools, so that you can build those friendships between communities, between U.S.-born English speakers and non-native English speakers. And that systems change, those practices that we want to be able to point to, that grassroots movement, has to come from within sometimes. So it's programs like Arise, and it's programs like Global Minds, and it's leaders like Nicole that are really pushing it forward.
Jackie, big picture here. I mean, what can be done? What can be put in place that might help either support or enforce some of the ideas that we've heard?
So one of the things that we've seen be really effective are collaborations between community groups and districts, specifically high-level administrators. So we, Education Law Center, was part of a working group that came out of a case that we filed on behalf of a student with special education needs. And part of this case, part of the settlement, was that the district would agree to convene, along with us, a working group to look at really communication with parents, because that was the issue in this case, across the whole district. So how can the district better communicate with limited English proficient parents and ensure that these families have access to the information that all other families have access to and that they are entitled to? And the working group brought together high-level administrators, so the head of special education, the head of ESL, the head of pupil services, people who could do things and make it actually happen, with community advocates, with different leaders, parents, community groups who knew what was happening on the ground and why it was that parents weren't getting this information. And bringing these groups together and then creating a set of policy recommendations that are actually going before the Pittsburgh Public School Board this fall and will hopefully be implemented shortly thereafter, to create better systems, better avenues to ensure that not only the programs are there, but then there's some sort of accountability to actually make sure that they're happening. So that's something that we've seen be really effective, is bringing the community in. School districts don't have to do this work in a silo. As Betty talked about, there are best practices from around the country, but there are also local leaders and parents and families who know what's going on and can provide so many resources and so much information if you just listen to them. And bring them to the table and hear their voices. And creating the space to do that, whether it's out of a case, out of a legal case, or more proactively, is such, what we've seen, such an effective tool.
And that's what we've been doing with the professional learning community, if I can just for a minute, is really, we're not even pretending to be the subject matter experts. We just create the space monthly, bring in the teachers who want to be there, who want to gain this, and bring in the subject matter experts like Jenna and Jackie to speak to these critically important resources and practices that are just get overlooked because you get so caught up in the day-to-day and or just aren't invested in you.
Yeah, for example, Jackie provided, from the Education Law Center, the EL Bill of Rights, they call it, and it lists the rights that English learners have and their families have. And just having that document with that information so clearly stated was something that, as a teacher, that was empowering for me to go into staff meetings at the beginning of the school year and be able to say, this is what our English learners are entitled to, this is what their families are entitled to, and then seeing, just in response to that, teachers coming to me and saying, okay, I'm going to send this thing home about open house. How can I get this into Chinese, or how can I get this into Spanish? And so it was just great to have that information and then be able to see it in play.
Obviously, there's so much that we could talk about all night about this topic, but thank you so much to all of our wonderful panelists for bringing so much knowledge to us. And thank you so much for listening and for engaging.
This has been a special presentation from 90.5 WESA on issues facing immigrant students, their teachers, and their families. The forum was held at the Pittsburgh Community Broadcast Center on Tuesday, September 4th.